You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to an author debriefing from the International Spy Museum. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Here at the museum, we get the most interesting authors, including journalists, scholars, former spies, and intelligence officers coming in to speak with our visitors and answer questions about their latest works dealing with espionage, intelligence, and other national security issues. Please join me in listening to another of our selected hour-long author debriefings.
So we are joined today by author Stephen Dando Collins, who is an award-winning Australian author and novelist. We are joined in a very interesting way, remotely. Stephen is in Australia, and actually we are recording this in the afternoon in Washington, D.C., and it is tomorrow morning in Australia. So this is the first time that SpyCast has defied the space-time continuum, so we're pretty happy about that. Yay, technology. But Stephen is an author, novelist, books on ancient history, American history, British history, Australian history, and French history. And in 2012, he actually launched the critically acclaimed Caesar the War Dog series of children's novels based on the true stories of modern-day military dogs serving in Afghanistan and elsewhere. He is a prolific writer, to say the least. He has published over 20 books, the most recent of which we will talk about today, Operation Chow Hound, the most risky, most glorious U.S. bomber mission of World War II. So, Stephen, thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at the International Spy Museum. I've read many, many books on World War II. My primary research also centers on the war. And I have to say I've heard bits and pieces about this operation, but I've never seen such a complete telling of this very interesting story, which, for those who don't know, at its heart is really a story of a humanitarian mission at the very end of the war to feed thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of starving Dutch civilians. On its face, the book is a great military history story with compelling personalities and certainly many of the usual suspects, Eisenhower, Montgomery, Beadle Smith. But I was surprised to see some interesting celebrities pop up throughout the book, from Walter Cronkite to Ian Fleming to Audrey Hepburn. My first question for you is, what brought you to this topic? I mean, there have been almost an unquantifiable number of books about World War II, and as important a story as this is, it's really fell through the cracks. How did you stumble upon it?
I've known this story for many years, and as with many of the books I write, I find a subject that interests me, I research it, and I wait for somebody else to write the book, thinking that there must be surely someone out there better qualified than me to tell the story. And as the years went by and the 70th anniversary of Operation Chow Hound approached, it is the 70th anniversary this year, in April, May. It occurred to me that, well, if I don't write it, perhaps nobody will. As you say, there have been books out there in Holland about these events, but they've really gone under the radar in the US and Australia. It's a little better known in Britain, but they tend to focus on the British efforts. And I found that in the US it was particularly in the mainstream unknown, and particularly the fact that if it had not been for the American military and political leaders, these operations probably would not have taken place.
And it's not as though some little-known American unit was involved. We're talking the 8th Air Force. We're talking Jimmy Doolittle's group here. I mean, this is a major operation run by people that anyone who studies World War II would know. And it's amazing that it's just never been told this way.
this is the amazing thing. As you say, tens of thousands of U.S. Personnel involved, and up to more than 400 B-17 bombers flying a day and every day. In my research, I found that often air crew were saying, this is the best thing we did during the war. For a change, we were doing something good. And we're not killing people. We're actually preserving lives. And so, again, I was amazed that the story had not been broadly told. It's pretty well known in the veterans groups, in the various bomb group associations. It's well covered. But again, in the mainstream, it's this wonderful story of a good deed done by the American people. It was just gone unnoticed.
There's so many great personalities in this book, and you do a great job in really bringing these characters to life. There really isn't a main character in this book, but if I had to pick one, it might be Prince Bernhard. In the second chapter of the book, you introduce him. The title of the chapter is Hitler's Secret Agent. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Prince Bernhard was a German prince from a disinherited German house. They had the name and he was a great deal else. He met and fell in love with the Crown Princess of Holland in 1936 at the Winter Olympics. His suit, if you like, was well received by the Queen of Holland, Queen Wilhelmina. He was a Protestant, like the Dutch royals. He came from a royal house. And she approved the match. So Juliana and Bernhard married in 1937. When he came to Holland, he disavowed his German background, took Dutch citizenship, and spoke Dutch in public all the time, and became very popular. He told the Queen and his bride that he had been a member of the Reiter SS, the SS cavalry, which was basically, he said, just an excuse to play with powerful cars. He always had an interest with fast cars throughout his life. But he said, apart from that, he had no connections with the Nazis. He said it helped him get through his university degree to have this connection with the SS. And so this was accepted as nothing too evil. And in fact, after the war, the Allies found that the Reiter SS was nothing more than a social club, and it was not actually classified as an illegal organization as the SS itself was. However, researchers in Holland in recent times have found that he was telling one or two porkies.
Right.
He had certainly been a member of the Nazi Party, having set down his membership details. He'd been a member of the SA.
Which is the brown shirts.
The brown shirts. After he graduated from the university in Berlin, he was employed by IG Farben, and they sent him to Paris, and he worked from their office as a salesman, and a very successful salesman, by the way. There was a report after the war done by General Eisenhower's economic office, and it reported that IG Farben had a massive influence on the German military, and even made the statement that without IG Farben there would not have been a Second World War. So this was partly because of their industrial might. They're involved in a whole range of different activities, particularly in the chemical area. But they had set up, IG Farben had set up a spy network, which ran throughout its offices around the world. And its employees, particularly its salesmen around the world, were required to submit monthly intelligence reports about everything from the locations of airfields and aircraft factories, shipping movements, the political machinations in various parts of the world, and so on. There was nothing to prove that Prince Bernhard had been one of these fires, but nothing to disprove it either.
Right.
And it is very likely that he was one of these agents submitting monthly reports over and above their normal work.
Well, some people may be listening to this thinking, well, you know, yeah, he's doing economic espionage for a private company. But of course, in Nazi Germany under fascism, the companies and the government were so closely collaborative that essentially he's working for the German government at this point.
Exactly. The reports went to the German High Command from IG Farben. So it wasn't purely economic. It was very military-based.
Well, Bernard, the prince would eventually make his way to England. I think this is where the story is very interesting, because he gets to England and the English aren't sure what to make of him. And so they ask one of their own intelligence people to vet the prince. And, of course, that's none other than Ian Fleming.
Yes, Commander Ian Fleming, as he was. Interestingly, the character he would create, I think that two later, was also a commander in the Royal Navy. And Fleming worked for military intelligence and was much respected by Prime Minister Winston Churchill. And he had the job of getting to know the Europeans, the exiled Europeans in the UK. And in part of this, he befriended Prince Bernard. They often went to lunch together at the Castle Grill. I recount in the book a particular dinner party where they find themselves in the middle of an air raid. And Fleming, being Fleming, he was a very suave gentleman, and decided that they needn't bother to go down to the air raid shelter. They'd continue with the dinner. And it was said that a very small and select German bomb landed on their very small and select dinner party, and it destroyed the stairway to the upper story apartment where they were having this dinner. And Prince Bernard, who was a tall, well-built chappy, managed to drop down to the ground below and then looked up and said to the others, "So, thank you for a very pleasant evening." and went home. And Fleming did the same, ducked himself off and drove home. So they knew each other well, even to the point that Fleming knew that Bernard's favourite drink was a vodka martini shaken, not stirred. So I wonder if that had any influence on James Bond's favourite tipple. So, as I say, they knew each other well. And Churchill, in particular, suspected Prince Bernard's loyalties. He was now a Dutch prince living in exile in England with the Queen Wilhelmina, his mother-in-law. But they knew he was German-born. His brother, his younger brother, was serving in the German military. And so Churchill was very reluctant when Queen Wilhelmina appointed Bernard commander of all Dutch forces, including the Dutch resistance. And Churchill asked Fleming to give a security clearance. And he did. He gave them the all clear, saying that as far as he was concerned, he could be trusted fully.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I mean, Bernard gets put in charge of the Dutch forces, and most importantly for our purposes, this includes what they call the Dutch Forces of the Interior. I'm not going to try to pronounce the two words start with B and S, but really it's the Dutch Resistance. And really, this gives them clearance, I want to say at the highest levels, but not necessarily, because of course he doesn't get told about arguably the most important mission of the war before Chowhound about Holland, and that's Market Garden, which plays a pretty vital role in the book. Bernard, of course, was passing along all the information he was getting from the Dutch resistance to General Montgomery and the people planning Market Garden. It wasn't a two-way street, though, was it?
It was interesting that they excluded Bernard, but they also excluded information that was coming from Holland,
right.
Intelligence information, which would told the Allies that there were two German panzer units, SS panzer units, resting in the very area that they were planning to make this huge parachute drop in the Arnhem area. And they ignored this. One of the reasons that they mistrusted intelligence coming out of Holland at that time is that they had learned in 1944 that the entire British SOE operation in Holland had been compromised by the Germans, SOE being Special Operations Executive. This was the British OAS, if you like. Their job was to assist the resistance, sending in agents and equipment and sabotage work in Holland and so on. And from 1942, the AbWERS Department 3F had captured a leading agent sent across by SOAE to Holland, had turned him, and thereafter every agent that the British sent to Holland was captured by the Germans and was either turned and was forced to work for the Germans or was put up against the wall and shot, which had worked the other way too. Any German agents caught in Britain were given the same options. So it was a quid pro quo. And it was not until 1944 that it was discovered that the AbWER had been sending false information from Holland for years.
Right.
And it was interesting that there was a British cryptographer, Leopold Marx, working in SOE, who had very serious suspicions about the messages coming out of Holland. He found there was not a single mistake for 2 years in the radio messages coming from the agents. As we know now, they were turned agents, and he suspected that that was the case. And the reason he was suspicious was because the messages sent by the SOE agents in Europe had to be very short because the Germans were adept at tracking down the transmitters.
Right, triangulation, yeah.
Exactly. And invariably, because they were rushing the messages, there often would be a mistake or two in the message. Yet for 2 years, not a single mistake, there were hundreds of messages coming out of Holland. And so Marx went to the head of the Dutch department of SOE and embarked on his suspicions, and they totally ignored it. Said, rubbish, rubbish. So this went on for until 1944, when they finally realised that Major Herman Giskus, the head of the AbWER in Holland, actually sent them an open message saying, please send more agents. Be pleased to make them welcome.
Yeah, no, that's an exceptional piece of intelligence analysis by the British cryptographer. Unfortunately, it was ignored, but you even write about this group called the Confidential Counselors, who had been so infiltrated by the Germans, and the Germans so enjoyed fooling London, they actually gave it a name. The England game, the ability to send disinformation and to mess with the English. I thought that was very fascinating what you wrote in the book there.
Yeah, it was. They called the game England's for you, and they had a great time, and particularly making up all this false information.
You talked about ignoring, Montgomery ignoring resistance intelligence about German forces. There's also imagery intelligence that showed that these forces were actually on the ground in the areas of Market Garden around Arnhem and Eindhoven. Why is Montgomery so intent on ignoring intelligence that was just hitting him in the face? I mean, imagery intelligence has nothing to do with the Dutch resistance or the Abwehr infiltrating it. Why is this intelligence ignored by Montgomery?
Well, Montgomery was a very arrogant gentleman. He actually went to school in the very place that I'm talking about, Tasmania. Believe it or not, his father was the bishop of Tasmania. He went to school in Hobart, Tasmania. But he turned out to be very arrogant and pig-headed. This information that was coming in went against his plans. And he didn't like it at all. Even General Beadle Smith, Eisenhower's chief of staff, became aware of this information, and he went to Montgomery put the information in front of him and said, will you now rethink the plan? Or at least there was another airborne division being held in reserve, and he said, would you at least add that to the plan to counter what looked to be units on the ground there. And Montgomery just shook his head and said, nonsense. And one of his subordinate generals, his intelligence officer, had come to him with these aerial photographs. For his troubles, he was sent on extended sick leave. They just didn't want to know. it went against their plan.
So Market Garden fails. It's a bold plan. It's the bridge too far. It almost opened up Germany to a very early end of the war. But it's not unsuccessful. And that's really where the theme of this book picks up, really talking post-Market Garden, because there was severe retribution against the Dutch population after Market Garden. And this really, you know, contributes to the severe food shortages that really threatens to kill tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Dutch citizens. And that's where Operation Chouwenhouwen comes into play. Am I right?
Exactly. At this time, there are 3.5 million Dutch civilians in Western Holland still under occupied German control. There are 120,000 German troops in Western Holland, including the Waffen-SS. I tell the story of Market Garden briefly in the book, so to create the context for what followed, as you say, this retribution. And the Germans had enough food to last 6 or 8 months, but they now tightened up all the food supplies. They cut off the power to the major cities in Western Holland.
In wintertime.
Yeah. They also forbid the locals to chop down trees to light their fire. And they even pack up the trolley car system in the major cities and send them off to Germany, to the bombed German cities. They were never used, they were often not found in storage after the war. And so the Dutch people came to call the winter of 1944-45 the Hunger Winter. And if you talk to Dutch people today, their eyes immediately light up when you mention this, because it's ingrained into Dutch history, the Hunger Winter. Particularly in the cities, the population began to suffer. In the country, the farmers were still able to use their own produce. But in the cities, the population was literally starved.
So I don't want to give away too much of the plot of the book, because I want people to actually read it. I want them to go buy it. To really appreciate this mission for themselves, but just to give a little bit of background, essentially what this mission is it turns American and British bomber forces that had just spent the last year and a half flattening Germany into food delivery vehicles, dropping thousands and thousands of tons of food all over the Dutch countryside, while the Germans still control Holland.
Yes, in the face of these 120,000 German troops, how are they going to do this? You mentioned how the confidential councils had been compromised along with the other resistance leaders in Holland. And Dr. Arthur Seethinkwa, the Nazi governor of Holland, sends an invitation out to several of these confidential councillors. These are the secret representatives of the Dutch government in Holland. Invite them to meetings. Informs them that he knows all about their secret operations. He even has a copy of what they call their confidential manifesto. With a smile, tells them that he's fully aware of what they're doing, but he wants to help the Dutch people. Seethinkwa had decided that he wants to look after himself with the end of the war approaching, and decided that if he did a good deed, it might count well at any future war crimes trial. And he gets them to make contact with London to say that the German authorities could be amenable to some sort of plan to feed the Dutch. So while you've got on the other side, you've got Queen Wilhelmina imploring Churchill and President Roosevelt to help her people, you've got on the other side Seethinkwa making moves to accommodate this. The German military are not so keen. They've got orders from Hitler to fight to the last man. They're calling Holland Fortress Holland. And so they're not very pleased about what Seethinkwa is up to. But eventually there are secret negotiations that take place in Acteveld in southern Holland, where General Beadle Smith's chief planner, Andrew Geddes of the Royal Air Force, Air Commodore Andrew Geddes, He's given less than 2 weeks to come up with this plan, which then has to be put to the Germans. And the plan is we will drop food daily to the Dutch. But they know they don't have enough transport aircraft. They certainly don't have enough parachutes. How are we going to do it? Well, Geddes has been one of the planners for the D-Day air operations. And he decided, okay, the major bombing operations have come to an end. We've run out of targets. Let's use the bombers. We'll use American B-17s and the British Lancasters. But how are we going to get the food to the Dutch on the ground? The aircraft certainly can't land. No, that's too great a risk. Let's put the food in the bomb bays and they'll just drop it from the bomb bay. So they conduct tests and they find that anything dropped from higher than 400 feet is likely to break on landing. So the aircraft are told to they've got to fly in low and they've got to drop their loads from about 300 to 400 feet. And so two Lancasters are sent on a trial run. Even before any agreement has been finalized with the Germans. And even though one of the Lancasters, flown by an Australian, hits the water, as one of its propellers hits the water, they fly so low over the North Sea, they successfully make drops at a racetrack and come back and report all is good. Meanwhile, the negotiations are still going on with the Germans, and we only have their verbal word that they won't fire on these aircraft flying so low any shell hitting them is likely to bring them down.
Well, you wouldn't even need an anti-aircraft shell at that point. You're flying so low that a German soldier with a Luger on the ground could potentially cause some damage if he decides to fire at one of these aircraft.
Exactly. And later, one of these two guinea pig aircraft, which is flown by a Canadian, they find a Luger bullet, a hole from a Luger, 9mm, in the fuselage. So some officer had to find them that flown over here. So there is this risk that the Germans will fire.
In Geddes, the British commander, is very famously said that this was as important operation as D-Day.
Exactly, and he should have known because he'd been one of the planners for D-Day. But yet, he had a year to plan for D-Day, and he had less than 2 weeks to bring this together. The Dutch people recall him well. He's known in Holland as the miracle worker. There is a monument to him, a walking track to Geddes Park. Bringing this together so quickly was quite miraculous.
So I want to ask you two separate questions, and then we'll wrap this up. One is, and this is more of an opinion question than anything else, the German governor, the political commander on the ground, who we had just finished talking about, he has at least the hope that allowing the Americans and the British to drop food to the Dutch civilians will get him out of trouble after the war is over. So not to give away the ending, this doesn't work out so well. He is executed along with many of the other Nazi commanders. Would you say this is unfair because of his role in feeding all these Dutch civilians, or is this just?
This is really a case of a mass murderer making a token, doing a token good deed at the end of his career. It shouldn't prevent him being tried and convicted of his earlier crimes. He claimed that he had tried to mitigate the number of Jews being transported away to the concentration camps and so on. But that had happened under his watch. It was under his watch that Anne Frank and her family had been captured and sent off to the concentration camps. So it was wishful thinking on his part.
Right.
At the end, he could weasel out of his and get away with his earlier crimes.
So there are a couple of relatively well-known personalities that pop up throughout this book that have bit parts or even some more important parts, certainly Walter Cronkite, but Farley Mowat, who some Canadians may know as a Canadian author and environmentalist, and of course Audrey Hepburn, who actually plays a pretty significant role, at least as a bystander in this operation. Are there any of those people? I mean, Mowat, to me, is fascinating because he carries out, or at least is is party to a mission behind enemy lines. It almost screws the whole thing up. But of course, he's responsible for technical intelligence, discovering what the Germans had been cooking up when it comes to special weapons. But Hepburn, for anyone who's lived over the age of, I don't know, even kids may know who Audrey Hepburn is here in the United States. Her whole life is really, shaped by this adventure of almost starving to death and then being rescued by this mission.
Yes, a few people would realize that she was there in Holland during the war. Her mother was a Dutch baroness, and they'd been living in England, just she and her mother, Audrey and her mother, just prior to the war. And her mother decided that if we go back to Holland, we'll be safe there, because during the First World War, Holland had been neutral and the Germans had not invaded. It was turned out to be a bad decision because the Germans did invade Holland in the Second World War. So she's in 1945, she's 15, Audrey, and they actually lived in Arnhem and had moved from Arnhem to a village called Velp, just 3 or 4 miles to the north, and were there during the Battle of Arnhem, during the Market Garden, and thinking they'd be safe there. But one of the German Panzer divisions actually based its headquarters in the village of Velp, was right in the middle of the battle. The city of Arnhem, after the battle, which the Germans won, they leveled much of Arnhem and forced the inhabitants. They gave them 24 hours to get out and turned it into something of a fortress. So a lot of refugees were on the roads, and Audrey's grandfather brought 40 of these refugees into his villa with his family. There wasn't enough food for people for them, let alone for the refugees. And Audrey, they were surviving on tulip bulbs at one point, and she would give her rations off to her mother and would fill up with water just to get by. And she said herself after the war that this experience had great impact on her physically and mentally. And any fans of Audrey Hepburn would know that she was way for them. And throughout her life, and part of this, much of this, was to do with this starvation during the Hunger Winter. You mentioned Walter Cronkite. He was a young war correspondent during Market Garden and was there in the middle of the fighting. And Moe, interestingly, as you say, he was a technical intelligence officer, and his commander, Major Cotton, came to him and said, come on, we're off on a mission. And it's been sanctioned by their superiors, but the superiors obviously didn't realize its ramifications. And they go dashing off from Canadian lines to German lines in Holland. Cotton has decided that he's going to go to the German commander, General Blaskowitz, and negotiate a peace. This is while Geddes is trying to negotiate with the same Germans to get them to agree not to shoot at the bombers flying operations at Chow Hound and Manor. I won't give away the story, but they very nearly succeed in destroying all the good work being done at higher levels.
It's fascinating how one or two people, I mean, it really is only one person, because Mott is kind of hiding down, hoping that he doesn't get killed because of his commander, can undo the work of so many people, or potentially almost undo the work of so many people. The author is Stephen Dando Collins, who's joined us here today. The book is Operation Chow Hound, the most risky, most glorious U.S. bomber mission of World War II. I highly recommend it as someone, again, who's read many, many books on World War II. This is not only a great story that most of you, I guarantee, have never heard of before, but it is interspersed with intelligence stories throughout, even though it itself is a story about feeding civilians. It is intelligence story at heart. So thank you for taking the time to join us here today, Stephen, and we appreciate you joining us here at the International Spy Museum.
Thank you, Vince. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this author debriefing. We'd like to know if you have any questions or comments about it. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. We look forward to you joining us again for another of our author debriefings. And thanks for listening.